Hello and welcome to today's episode of the ABCs, Authors Between the Covers. What makes successful authors tick? What does it take to sell that manuscript? Is self-publishing a good option? Or is selling your book to a big publishing house still the only way to fly? What about keeping up with your first big success? We'll talk about all this and more on today's show, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. The winner of the Massachusetts Book Award for Fiction, Dawn Tripp, is the author of novels Moontide, The Season of Open Water, and Game of Secrets, a Boston Globe bestseller. Her essays have appeared in the Virginia Quarterly Review, The Believer, The Rumpus, Psychology Today, and on NPR. So we are thrilled to be talking to her about her fourth novel, Georgia, a biographical novel about American artist Georgia O'Keeffe, published by Random House, coming in February 2016. A graduate of Harvard, Dawn lives in Massachusetts with her family, and it was during a visit to the Whitney Museum in New York City in 2009, where O'Keeffe's abstractions were being featured, that Dawn says she was overturned. She asked herself, who was the woman, the artist, who made these works? Why was she not recognized for her sheer visionary power during her lifetime? And of course, what was her 30-year relationship really like with the man who discovered her, famous photographer and owner of Gallery 291, Alfred Stieglitz? So thank you so much for being here on the Incandescent Radio Network. Dawn, we are really, truly thrilled to be talking to you.
Thank you, Hope.
Okay, so now tell us about this book. What drew you to Georgia O'Keeffe and her story?
Well, like you, as you mentioned, I really came to O'Keeffe's story through her art. And, you know, like many, I'd known her primarily as the woman who, as an older woman, graced Life magazine in that iconic image of, you know, a kind of aged doyenne of the Southwest with the desert spread out behind her and the image of her cow skull red, white, and blue kind of featured in a little thumbnail image. I knew her through that image, and I knew her representational work. I knew her cow skulls and her calla lilies, but I had never experienced her abstract art. And I went to that show at the Whitney, and for me, that show was a revelation. And it was there that I learned that just about 100 years ago, in fact, exactly 100 years ago, at 29 years old, O'Keeffe was creating these radically new abstract forms when only a handful of American artists were bold enough to explore abstract language in their art. And her works of that time and the abstractions that she continued to create throughout her life were ambitious, and they were just these gorgeous shapes of color and form designed to express and evoke emotion, and they were stunningly original. And I just wanted to know who was this young woman, this artist who made these shapes, and what did she think? What was she feeling? What did she want? What was happening in her life at this period of time? And I wanted to know why I'd never seen this side of O'Keeffe before. And in that exhibition at the Whitney, her art was shown alongside photographs that Alfred Stieglitz had taken of her as part of a serial portrait which spanned 20 years and was comprised of 300 images. And Alfred Stieglitz was a famed gallery owner. He was the father of modern photography. He was also her manager, her dealer, and he became her lover and then her husband. And, you know, the images of his photographs of O'Keeffe at that exhibition, there were her hands, her face, her body. Some were clothed, some were nude. And also at that exhibition at the Whitney, there were excerpts of the letters that O'Keeffe and Stieglitz exchanged over the course of their relationship. And the language of those letters, it was so sharply intimate. It was like longing and heartbreak and desire. And the language felt true to the pictures that I was seeing on the wall. It also felt aligned with the kind of that, you know, intense sexuality and sensuality of the photographs, but at the same time, it felt so at odds with the image I'd always held of O'Keeffe. And, you know, I was fascinated by this. You know, here was a woman we're all familiar with, a woman we all know of, and yet on some level, a woman that we barely know at all.
Yeah, it's amazing, right? And I think over the course of her life, you talk about this in the book, which is, you know, let's really make it clear. This is a novel. You dove into her psyche, what she must have been feeling and thinking. And it is historic fiction, of course. So talk a little bit about that. How was it like? What was it like to get into her head, into her heart?
I knew that I wanted it to be a novel, and I knew I wanted it to be first person. So I wanted to write it from her point of view with imagined thoughts and dialogue, but grounded in actual events and peopled, you know, only with real life characters. And I knew that I didn't want to write the story of the O'Keefe we all know. I wanted to write the story of how she became the O'Keefe we know. And fiction is this curious tool to get at a different side of the truth. And in Nabokov has this great expression for it. He calls it the shimmering go-between, and that's the space that I wanted to write into, the space between what took place and what could have. It actually was harder than I at first expected it would be, because it took me about a year to really find the voice of the book. I did a ton of research. I read 5 or 6 biographies. I filled notebooks because I still write longhand. And I looked at art. I looked at O'Keefe's art. Stieglitz's photographs of her, the work of other artists in their circle. And I started taking my own photographs every day because I was trying to see the world the way a visual artist might see the world, you know, trying to break the world down into shape and color and line. And I took pages and pages of notes, but I couldn't quite nail the voice. And throughout that first year of work on the book, I'd catch these sort of momentary glimmers. Often when I was outside or out for a run, I'd catch glimpses of what I thought the voice would be, but I couldn't really grasp it. And so the story itself kind of stayed just beyond my reach. And apart from, you know, that exhibit of the Whitney, at the Whitney, where they had little excerpts of her letters, I stayed away from reading material that was written in her own voice, even her memoir, because I knew that before I could do that, before I allowed myself to do that, I really had to find the voice of the story, the voice of my novel, the voice that would tell, you know, that would speak the story to me. And at my desk, when it hit me, I was outside with my two boys, and it was a Sunday afternoon. It was in April. It was like oddly warm, and we were down at the river, kind of the first day at the river, and they had their jeans rolled up and they were playing in the water, and I was lying in the sun, and I heard the first words of the novel, you know, the first line of what is now the first lines of the novel, "I no longer love you as I once did," in the dazzling rush of those early days. And I remember that moment so clearly, because I remember sitting up and feeling that voice in me, and I remember looking around and the whole world was different. And I started the book the following day.
How amazing. And truly, that first page, it makes you cry. You read, you know, I think I was into the second paragraph before, and I could so relate as a woman at 51 to how she might have felt, you know, in a relationship with someone who changed her life, but yet she was trying to hold on to it. And I think it's just, I think this speaks to women and what it's like to be a woman. And then it's got the nuanced layers of that fascinating woman's life, which is just, thank you for writing the book. I said this to you before we started our conversation. Do I want to say it on the air?
You know, I feel like I grew up in the course of writing this book. I know that might seem like a strange thing to say. I mean, I'm 47. I probably should have grown up a while ago. But there were just certain things that I learned about what it means to be a woman and what it means to be an older woman. And I use the word older, like, in every best sense of that word, because it's a word that I believe in. Like, I feel that aging, I've really begun to become the person that I want to be, that I'm meant to be. And one of the things that O'Keefe did in the course of her life is that she made bold choices throughout her life. Like, we sometimes imagine, like, the bold choices or the brave choices, or those are reserved for the young. And yet I feel like she started, I mean, she always was a willful person and a willful young woman, but she started, you know, making intensely bold choices and continued to do so. you know, as she aged. And I love that. It's just really taught me to think about my own life in those terms. And bold choices don't have to be big sweeping choices. You know, they can be small choices and, you know, small decisions that we make to, you know, to live a life more intimately and more intensely on our own terms.
That's also what I love about fiction, because it transcends you. You live in this world of the author's imagination, but also historical fiction particularly, because you go back and you're in your present life and you learn so much. So I think that's my next question to you. What did you learn about Georgia O'Keeffe that you didn't know before you started doing all this research?
Everything. She was not at all what I had grown up expecting. I think that she was just a very, I mean, she had that ferocious kind of will, which I think that comes through, that sort of something that came through all the way through her life. But, you know, when she was older, she was very, you know, she really held the world at arm's length. And so there's a remoteness that we associate with her. And she just had this, you know, driving passion. You know, she was a really passionate person in every sense of that word. And she, you know, she really believed in, you know, she was kind of a woman who owned her own sexuality in ways that were progressive to her time. She allowed, you know, sexual passion to be an inspiration for her art, but she explicitly resisted and ultimately condemned, you know, the kind of sexualized, eroticized terms that were, you know, assigned to her art, because that's not who she was. You know, she was a naturalist. She was an abstract painter. And she was just doing wildly innovative works, you know, that in many ways are just starting to be recognized as kind of presaging some of, the other artistic movements that took place much later in the, in the 20th century. You know, she's being, her influence and impact are being reassessed. There's an exhibit coming next summer, actually, at the Tate Museum that's a kind of a retrospective of her, but is also a reassessment of her influence and who she was as an artist.
Did you feel like, I mean, it felt like this to me as I was reading the book, do you feel like you were channeling her, that she called to you as you were walking through that museum that day, and you have been taking a ride with her ever since?
There were days that I felt really close to her. There were other days that I felt like it was hard. You know, it was hard to kind of break into her, you know, kind of crack open that voice. That may seem like a strange way of describing it. You know, I think writing is something that, you know, at its best, it is that kind of channeling. You feel like it's running through you. But there are so many days when it's just a much harder road, when things aren't working right and you need to kind of go and find your way back in. And so it was a long time. I mean, this book took me about 5 years. And so there were spaces of, you know, there were stretches of time where I felt like I was really closely aligned with the story and what it needed to be. And then there were other times that were just more difficult and more challenging. But that's just the way it is with every book. And every book is different. And that's one of the things that I love about my work, is that every day is, you know, is a new place.
And in fact, this is your fourth novel, as we said in the introduction. So tell us about your career. So you've written all these books and you went to Harvard. Take us back to that and how you got to be a writer.
Well, I wanted to be a writer when I was about five. It was something I've always wanted to do. I mean, that was something I grew up reading stories. My mom, I've always loved stories. I love to read. Growing up, my mom would bring me to the library and to the bookstore, and she read to me every night and really introduced me to literature and to books with strong female characters, often written by strong female writers like the Bronte sisters and Emily Dickinson. And I remember as a teenager, she gave me Margaret Atwood novels, Surfacing and The Handmaid's Tale. And I believe in that. I believe that culture of reading as a child, and loving stories and having that culture, growing up in that culture, is so endemic and sort of intrinsic to becoming a writer. My sons are 9 and 14, and they're both really strong readers, and I still read to them every night. And I just feel like that matters, affirming the value of books and the place and power of stories in our lives. That's something that I believe in. It wasn't until, though, I was I was in 10th grade. I was in an English class, and I actually, it was Mr. Rossiter's class in my 10th grade English. And I remember he was talking about, I believe it was T.S. Eliot, and I remember it was snowing outside, it was winter, and I remember looking up at him and seeing this fire in his eyes as he was talking about this piece of literature. And I remember thinking to myself, I want to write something someday that makes someone feel like that. And I feel like that was the moment when this desire to be a writer became hitched to a more concrete desire. And then when I was at Harvard, I didn't write any fiction, actually. I only wrote poetry. I studied poetry with Seamus Heaney, who and that workshop had a profound effect on me. And there's still kind of things that he talked about and that he and I talked about that are still kind of changing the decisions I make on a day-to-day basis in my writing work. And it wasn't until I graduated from college that I started writing a novel, and I wrote it for 8 years, and it kept getting stronger and stronger, and it kept getting rejected and rejected, and I mean, I think I probably got 100 rejection letters, and finally I just put it away. I was done with it. And then I had moved back to the small town where I used to spend the summers as a kid, and I came up with this idea for another story. And I wrote it in about a year and a half, and I sold it, and that was my first novel. But that novel I wrote in my 20s, the one that is still under the bed, you know, that failed, that kind of died, but that's where I really learned how to write. You know, that kind of failed novel was really the greatest teacher that I ever had.
That's great advice for other writers who want to make it, and you just don't quit. Was there just something in you that said, I got to do this, I got to keep doing this?
With that novel or with the work of being a writer?
Both.
With that novel, I mean, you have a fire in you for a certain story. I mean, otherwise you couldn't sustain it for 320 pages. I mean, you have to really want to, you know, you have to really want to write a story in order to live with it, you know, for the several years that it takes to get it down and get it right and rework it and revise it and polish it and all those different, you know, tear it apart and rewrite it again, like all of those different stages of writing. You have to really want to tell that story. But I think as you grow, and what happened to me in my 20s is I grew, I outgrew it. You know, I outgrew that other book. But that's where I learned how to write. That's where I learned how to write fiction, was in the course of writing and rewriting that book that is now under the bed. And then in terms of wanting to be a writer, it is about sticking with it, but it's also what I do. You know, it's how I make sense of the world. You know, I kind of, when I go out for my runs or my walks, and I mean, words are just how I make sense of the world, if that makes sense.
Of course it does. So what did you do to feed yourself while you were trying to make it as an author?
I worked in I taught writing. That was one thing that I did in the end of my 20s. And then I worked at the Charles Playhouse in Boston, and I got a job working that didn't start. It went from 2 to 10 so that I'd be able to write in the morning. And then I also catered. So I kind of patched together a life that would allow me to really focus on what I wanted to do.
Isn't that amazing? I love how people who are driven to create just work it out. And that's really, I think that's what separates successful authors from those who just wish that they could do something like this.
But I think you have to want to do it. I mean, I feel like in many ways what separates, it's like a necessity. Like, it's not just about wishing or wanting. It's just something that you're driven to do. You know, I wrote a piece for the Virginia Quarterly Review where I talked about how, you know, writing isn't always something that makes me happy. You know, it isn't always something that I love to do, but it's something that I'm driven to do. You know, it's something that I have to do. And that necessity, I think, is actually, you know, in all its kind of, in all its joys and challenges and kind of burns and scrapes and cuts, like that necessity is actually what is the difference.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, and I think that is that passion. So relate that back to Georgia O'Keeffe. Do you think that's what she knew too?
I think she always had a drive. I mean, her drive to be an artist That was her passion. That's what she wanted to do. And she gave it up a few times. I mean, I almost quit a few times in my 20s when I wasn't publishing that, you know, I wasn't able to kind of publish that or place that other novel. But she, you know, and she gave it up a few times when economically she just couldn't make it. You know, she worked as an illustrator and she decided, and then she worked as an art a teacher, but she wouldn't work on her own art. But it was just, that was the impulse in her. That was the burn in her. That was the drive, was to be an artist and to make art. And she made intense, incredible sacrifices, you know, for the sake of her art. And, you know, I've thought a lot. I've lived a lot with the question, did she have to make the choices she made? I mean, I think as a, you know, I'm a mother of two boys. Like, I have a very, you know, we live a very kind of quiet, you know, run-of-the-mill life. And, you know, I volunteer at my son's school and I teach Sunday school at our friend's meeting. Like, these are things I coach, you know, I assistant coach soccer for my younger son. Like, these are things that really matter to me. But I've been able to have those things and also write. And I just wonder if a woman living at the time when Georgia lived, if she had that same choice. You know, that's a question I've really sat with. And I don't have an answer, but it's a question that I sit with.
And talk a little bit about her relationship with Stieglitz. And you say in the book that it's told, a lot of this, her story is told through his story. What was your assessment of their marriage?
It was a wild one. it was so, their affair was so loaded. I mean, there was desire and ambition and love and sex and fame and betrayal. There was a search for artistic freedom. And the more I learned about that, the more I wanted to know. I mean, they had this intensely stormy passion, and that characterized their marriage. And that was so intriguing to me. But the politics of their relationship and how those politics impacted the work of both artists, that was even more intriguing. I mean, here you had this young woman, strong, fiercely intelligent and independent, with a stunning artistic talent and a revolutionary vision years ahead of her time. And here was a man, the father of modern photography, you know, a famed gallery owner, but at the tail end of his own artistic career. And he felt so deeply in love with her. He had such faith in her greatness. But he needed to orchestrate every element of the world around him, almost to the point of being blind to the risk of losing what he wanted most. And their relationship was so compelling to me, their relationship and how it was a source of intense freedom and expansion for her at the beginning, and then slowly became something else that she had to break free of. She was a strong woman, and she was in a relationship with a strong and powerful man. And those dynamics had a tremendous impact on the evolution of her art and the evolution of her career and the choices that she made at the age that I am now in her midlife, and then also the choices that she would continue to make for the rest of her life to become the icon we know.
And it's so, I mean, it's telling of the time, but also of this force to be reckoned with, which is what makes her, you know, it's funny that as I was reading your story, your author's note, I remember 10, 15, maybe even longer, walking through a museum in D.C., seeing her work and his work and feeling that same pull, like, who was this woman? How did she get from here to there? I love that you took it to this next place. It's just thrilling. Can you read from that first page to end our podcast for our listeners? Because it is so gorgeous and powerful. I just want to give our listeners a taste of what they're in store for in Georgia.
I would love to. I'll read the first few pages. I no longer love you as I once did in the dazzling rush of those early days. Time itself was feverish then, our bodies filled with fire. Your fingers inside me, mouth grazing, my throat, breast, thigh. The metallic scent of the dark room, smells of sweat and linseed oil, a stain of cocoa on the dining table. It was all smashed together back then, art, sex, life, mixed into the perfect color. Every shadow had a substance, shape, and tone. Your bowler hat, the lead-rolled gleaming whiteness of an empty canvas, tubes of paint lined up. My dressing gown on the floor and you above me, light moving on your shoulders. Your eyes did not leave my face. When you touched me then, you moved so close to me, so close and hot and fast and deep. I no longer love you that way. My hands are cool now, the past remade and packed away. Sometimes, though, late at night, the air lifts and I feel it. The faint burn of your eyes on my closed lids still. That sense of you rushing back in.
Magnificent. You just want to keep turning those pages. Everyone must have this. Oh, we'll say this again. It's being published in February 2016.
February 9th, 2016 with Random House. And I mean, you know, it's interesting. The team there is so phenomenal. I've been so fortunate. My editor has been my editor for all four books. And the whole team has just been so dedicated to this particular story and really feeling, you know, I can feel they really believe, they get that this story is relevant to women today. It's relevant to art today. And I love that. I just feel like there's nothing more humbling and more gratifying and meaningful as an artist to feel like you're, you know, you're the team of people that you work with really believes in what you've done.
Oh, that's wonderful. And congratulations to you. Fourth novel, but, you know, it sounds like there are many more to come, and this is certainly going to be a smash hit. And I also want to make a quick reference. I've had the privilege for Costco Magazine where this we're going to be doing an article on Georgia. I've had the honor of writing for Costco for a long time. I've had the opportunity to interview Barbara Shapiro, who wrote The Art Forger a couple years ago, and she's a good friend of yours. So we want to give a little plug to that. And tell us quickly before we let you go about your relationship with some of these other amazing writers.
Barbara is, she's a special person. She actually has a new book out called The Muralist that is getting an amazing amount of praise everywhere, and it's phenomenal. It's a brilliant work. Just came out earlier. It just came out in November. And, you know, I feel like the relationship that I have with her, I've just, you know, she read an earlier draft of Georgia, and, you know, I kind of sat in her house for 8 hours. You know, we worked through kind of what wasn't working in the book at that point in time, and the book is so much stronger as a result of her impact and her insights and influence. And I think that relationship among other writers, that writers have with other writers, is such an inspiring one. It's such a meaningful one. I have close friendships with a number of other writers, and they're, you know, we read each other's work and we support each other with, you know, kind of just our sense of what's happening in publishing, our sense of what are the joys and challenges of the creative process. Like those are relationships that I really value, and they're relationships that really support me and my work in the world, and also support more essentially my belief in the power of words. And I'm lucky to be, I'm actually married to my husband, and I actually have an amazing creative partnership, and he's actually the person that first reads my work. And, you know, when he works through one of my early drafts, it's not just that he's commenting on what's on the page, but he also will point out some aspect of the story I could push deeper into or some risk I haven't taken yet. And he gets the raw vision of what I'm trying to do, and he knows my strengths and weaknesses, and he's just helped me to become more ruthless, you know, with my own work. And, you know, those relationships are an incredible gift, you know, to have that kind of dynamic tension and that creative intimacy in a relationship. You know, it's someone who really sees you, whether it's a friend or a partner who really sees you as an artist and really sees your work as a writer and believes in it, that, again, is just, you know, something that sustains me.
Beautiful. Well, here's to being fierce and moving past the blocks, as women like Georgia O'Keeffe and yourself have done. So thank you, Dawn Tripp. It has been an honor to talk to you today for the Incandescent Radio Network, and I look forward to writing this article up for Costco Magazine and my magazine, Be Incandescent. Be on the lookout for Georgia, coming February 9th, 2016. And you are listening to the Incandescent Radio Network. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs. I look forward to talking to you soon. That's it for today's episode of the ABCs. Authors Between the Covers, hosted by journalist and publisher Hope Katz Gibbs, author of Truly Amazing Women Who Are Changing the World and PR Rules, The Playbook. Be sure to check back next week on the Incandescent Radio Network for another interview with a successful author who is happy to share their story. Here's to writing your heart out and keeping your dreams alive. Thanks so much for listening.